Hello, welcome to Who Are Politicians? I'm your host, Matt Antonelli. If you want to skip straight to my interview with Edward Carroll, the Queensland State President for the Australian Progressives, you can look at the episode description for the timestamp. Otherwise, just some little updates. Next week's episode features Ali King, who is the Queensland MP for Palmerstone, so I'm really looking forward to releasing that. It was really great to catch up with her on Bribey Island, just a lovely place to visit and go, and it was great to talk to her about, that area and things she's been able to do. Also, it's really great to see people listening. I'm surprised by the high number of plays. It's nice to see that people are listening. If you are listening but you're not subscribed, because there's a lot of people who listen but aren't subscribed, could I encourage you to do so? It just really helps me with, having a nice amount of followers, and that the podcast gets to more people and that kind of stuff. So it'd be really great if you can follow. Leave a rating, leave a review, all those normal things. Tell a friend who loves podcasts about it. That would be great. If you do want to check out my Facebook, just because that's where I post all my schedules and stuff like that, there's a link down in the episode description. If you listen to the episode and you want to check out some more things about Edward Carroll, I've also put links to some of his websites there as well. But I hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you for listening. Hello, welcome to Who Are Politicians? I'm your host, Matt Antonelli, and today I'm joined by Edward Carroll, the Queensland State Leader of the Australian Progressives.
G'day, Matt. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. How's things?
Yeah, it's been really busy.
I can imagine, yeah. So maybe because, even though it's, in real time, it's probably been about 4 years since I think we spoke. Hmm. 3 years. It was just after the last, or just before the last election.
Yeah.
And we talked about the Australian Progressives, who they are, what they do. So maybe give us a bit of a refresher. What makes your party, what are your core values? How are you different from the other parties?
Yeah, so Australian Progressives federally is a political party that's been around since about 2015. We first formed out of the movement that was explicitly against Tony Abbott's prime ministership. Everything that he was trying to do, his same-sex marriage stuff, everything around the bad politics that he was pushing, there was a big reaction against that. So there was a movement called the March in March. And out of that movement, there was a group of people that got together and said, there is a space in Australian politics that's currently missing, and Australian Progressives formed within that space.
Yeah.
So we have we've been operating since then, and we have six core values that we stick to, what we call the six E's. They are ethics, evidence, empathy, engagement, empowerment, what's
equality?
The sixth one? Equality. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, I have the little list from last time we spoke.
You've always got to be able to rattle them off. They are our core values, and they're kind of like the driving forces behind the party. So they inform the way that we want to do politics. They inform the way that we want to create policy and engage with the Australian public and with other parties as well.
And I think we even discussed last time how they're not really, it's not like an ideology kind of focus. It's more of a, every issue is viewed through the lenses of these six E's, pretty
absolutely
much.
Yeah,
I think your role has changed. Last time we spoke, you were the candidate for Miller.
Indeed.
What have you been doing with the party since then?
Yeah, so we had ever since I ran as an independent candidate with the party backing in the 2020 state campaign, we've been slowly moving towards getting registered in the state.
Mm-hmm.
We've stepped up in that area. We're coming really, really close now. We've got a working constitution for our membership. We're getting out there. We've got a state secretary and a state treasurer. So we're starting to form a little bit more of an active push towards registration. So there will soon be a website up there, it should be maybe a week or two away, that people can start to go to see our state policies.
Cool. Well, that will... by the time this goes out, and hopefully that will be up, I can put a link in the description.
We're working towards that. So that's really exciting, because that means that we can start to run candidates across the state, which is definitely going to be a focus of mine.
And obviously, like, you're, I mean, in the scheme of things, it's quite a young party. What's that been like having to establish, you know, you've got your values, you, as a party gets bigger, and obviously has to respond to, like, having lots of different perspectives within the party. So how have you guys gone managing with, like, that kind of initial growth from the start of your party?
So it's, the party's changed and grown a lot in the years we've been around for. So in the early days, we had people from, it was the Smashed Avocado Movement. So like a specific housing affordability advocacy group. They were really heavily involved in the early days. And they've since either absorbed into the party or gone on to do their own thing separately. So we've kind of taken on board that housing affordability kind of framework from those early days, and we've really run with that. We've also solidified our objectives a lot more. We've kind of realised there are three key things that we want to focus on policy-wise to achieve as a party. So primarily being an anti-poverty party. So that's a massive issue. It's a very, very growing issue, unfortunately, in Australia at the moment. And we've had a focus on that since the start, but it's become very clear that we need a party that really pushes hard for combating poverty and waking political parties up to say, hey, don't do the wrong thing. The other big one is in integrity. Federally, we saw the results from the last 10 years of government, just what can go wrong when integrity isn't in politics. So kind of helping to restore a lot of that at the federal level and at the state level in Queensland as well. There is a lot of issues surrounding integrity at the state level in Queensland, and that's something that I really want to focus on with Queensland Progressives. And then the third thing that we focus on is combating climate change in particular, but just the way that Australia should shape itself as a nation going into the rest of the 21st century and the next 100 years, the challenges of climate change and how we build our society and what that society looks like is a really big issue, and that's something that that we need more political parties to take more seriously.
So there's probably a little bit to discuss in there. When you talk about housing affordability and homelessness and that kind of thing, do you think, because I recently had Jonathan Sranganathan on as well, former councillor for the Gabba, and we were talking about how, well, he was talking about how there's these little tent cities that are appearing in the within Brisbane.
Yes, they're growing.
And that it's kind of, on one hand, it's lovely that these people are supporting each other, but how does it get to that point? Like, do you think that this is a problem that we've just been ignoring completely? Or how is our response actually, as a state or as a nation, like, just been to sort of kind of like brush it under the sheets and like hope that it goes away, or what do you think the mentality of the government is on this issue?
It's hard to say where their focus is, but this isn't really a new thing. This problem has been building for probably a good 30 years at least. And it really started, I would say, in around about the 1990s. So when you had both federal and state governments in Queensland at the time, had that really big focus on neoliberalism, on privatisation, on outsourcing government services. And we saw that both in the anti-welfare kind of policies that they had, Keating and Howard's privatising the welfare system, getting rid of the old Commonwealth Employment Service, going towards the job service providers, and kind of almost gamifying that welfare system and making people jump through hoops to get welfare and support. And at the same time, we started seeing public housing getting sold off, all those assets getting sold off, the privatisation of those services. So what government used to do now becomes the remit of charities to provide, and then they need to find the funding for that. Yeah. So there's that struggle from that side of things. You can kind of see how that's built up to the problem that we have today.
And making people jump through hoops is sort of a way to deter them from getting support, and then that's obviously money then the government can kind of hold
yeah,
on to then.
Very much so, yeah. They talk about, you know, cost-cutting measures, savings measures, whatever that is. You know, the efficiency dividends, I think, was the political speak from a few years ago. And all that means at the end of the day is not getting the services to the people that need them and refusing those services through whatever means.
And the other thing, integrity. Like, last time we spoke, we talked about how there's like a lack of engagement from, you know, probably a sizable group of the public that mistrust, they don't have a lot of trust in politicians. Yeah. How would you go about rebuilding that trust? Because you want to bring integrity back into politics. So if you had a few members, or like, what would you be pushing to do to try and clear that up?
It's really not an easy thing to do. And one of the main things that we've seen since we last sat down and spoke is the rise of the independence movement, or what they call the teal wave.
Mm.
And what's really interesting about that teal wave is it is a complete rejection of party politics. And it's exactly that lack of integrity, that lack of trust in political parties and in the systems of politics that people are rejecting. And so this movement has come up with, you know, Ruth McGowan and Helen Haynes in Indi, and then the other ones, you know, with the 2022 election, I think we had 10 MPs that were independent.
It seems like Goldstein and North Sydney, Wentworth,
all of these seats, you know, there were a lot from the 2022 election that there were, even, you know, in 2019, there were a good two or three seats that were independent as well. So the movement has been growing for a good few years. And it's a lot of the values that a lot of these members have, you know, they're either former Liberal strongholds or very, soft conservative seats, you would say. They're very wealthy suburbs.
Those small L Liberal kind of,
Very much so. And you know, they're losing the trust in government because that integrity is just not there. And instead of turning to a different political party, they're saying there's no political party that we can trust or that we can go to, and so they're going to independence instead.
I find that interesting because obviously, like, Cathy McGowan and Helen Haynes, they had that, the Voices camp. Like, they would, you know, the community would elect they'd pre-select someone in the area. Do you think that you know, political parties need to learn to be, maybe the major parties in particular need to learn to be a bit, you know, more flexible as opposed to not just having their people just follow like a strict party line?
Absolutely. The clearest example to me to that was in Sydney in the 2022 election, the seat of Fowler. So that, Dai Lee, who won that seat, she doesn't consider herself to be one of those teal independents. Mm. You know, she wasn't part of that Voices for wave. The reason why Dai Lee was elected was explicitly as a rebuke of Labor's pre-selection policies and the fact that they tried to airdrop in someone that had no connection to the community.
Yeah.
So when Thule, who was a local Labor candidate, she put herself up for pre-selection. She was looked over completely by the party mechanism, by Labor, because they wanted to put Christina Keneally in to what they saw as a safe seat. And that lack of community activation, I should say, that lack of community engagement was really, really clear. And they said, no, you need to listen to us. People don't just accept what parties say anymore. And if they don't like what they're doing, they will go elsewhere. And that was a very clear example of that.
And I think an example of where, like, a party, like, someone who is still within a party but, you know, does listen to their community, someone, like, I watched Bridget Archer. Like, she's obviously a Liberal member, but is someone who appears to be someone who's a bit more, you know, listens to her community, speaks what they want her to say, as opposed to being totally beholden to that party line.
It's a really interesting dynamic to read from a party politics kind of standpoint, because on the one hand, people see the modern Liberal Party it's a very conservative party. It's a very locked down kind of, we don't like change, we don't like individual, you know, you do what we want you to do kind of party. But they still have this small L liberalism in the lower level membership and their backbench MPs. And they still have this ethos hidden behind that conservative outer layer, saying that, you know, we still value individual thought. We still value that classic liberalism that used to be a lot bigger in the party. And it would actually fit quite well in Australian progressives because, you know, we do value individual thought. We do value individual opinion. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, the right to dissent. The Liberal Party, out of what you'd call the three major parties, so Liberals, Labor and Greens, they're actually the only ones that do have set rules in their constitutions for dissent within the parliament.
That's right, yeah.
Whereas
if you're a Labor and you dissent, you're out of the party.
Very much so. So Labor has really hard, explicit lines. You cannot cross the party lines. You cannot cross the floor for any reason whatsoever. Greens do have that. They just don't publicly admit it. They have a closed caucus and they don't go outside of that. So they're a bit... They have the same outcome, but they just hide that behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And Liberals, they kind of put it out in the open a little bit, which is... It is a really interesting point of difference considering how their politics is very different to what the base membership is. And so it's a really interesting dichotomy of that individual liberty and that party line.
Yeah. Now, we should stop talking about other parties. Come back to your party.
Yes.
I want to kind of get into the state election next year, but just before I get into that, last time we talked a lot about equality for First Nations peoples. And so I thought it'd be really good to get your perspective and the party's, you know, stance on the voice referendum that's coming up.
Because, yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's some people that think it's tokenistic and there's some people that think it will make real change and some people that don't, you know, are very apathetic towards it. Yeah. So Australian progressives, what do they think of the proposal?
So the party officially endorses the Yes campaign. We back the voice. We fully agree with the Uluru Statement from the Heart and the entire process that went into creating the lead up to the Voice to Parliament referendum. It is really important to note that I can't remember who it was. I think it was Natasha Turnbull Roberts, who was an Indigenous journalist. She noted that there are three camps in this current debate. You know, there is the Yes camp, there's the legitimate No camp, which is, you know, black sovereign voices or Indigenous voices that dissent against what the voice stands for as, you know, in terms of black sovereignty and First Nations rights. And then there's what she called the illegitimate or the racist No campaign, which is, you know, we're seeing that ugly side start to really come out now. We're seeing that, you know, if you don't know, vote no, those kind of negative... policies that we see, they've coloured other conversations in the past. They're back again, basically. And so it's important to note that there are three distinct camps, not two camps. And there is relevant debate to be had. But in far too many cases, there's not enough ability to have the nuanced conversation that you need to. So it does become this kind of binary that you have to sit in yes or no.
Yeah, because it's not like when you get that piece of paper, you can say no with these reservations.
Yeah,
exactly. You only got the option of yes or no.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, I identify with the arguments and I speak with a lot of First Nations people that are within the Black Sovereignty Movement. I'm really closely connected with movements like the work that Sisters Inside do. They're a prison abolitionist group from people mostly Indigenous based, but they're people that have first hand experience of the prison and justice system and how bad it can be for so many people, and they work to kind of challenge that system from their own lived experience. So the voices that they have, and you know, voices like Debbie Kilroy, even, you know, national voices like Lydia Thorpe, they are really valid voices and they shouldn't be dismissed readily.
Yeah.
Because there are important conversations to have with what they have to say.
And so from your like perspective, or the party's perspective, is it that if you vote yes, at least we've got like the start of something, as opposed
Yeah.
to like there's obviously these concerns, but we can kind of, if we can get started, we can kind of work on all of that.
Absolutely, yeah. So the way that the statement from the heart lays out voice, treaty, truth, and in that specific order, it's been voted for, from the statement from the heart committee. People have been collaborating from this since, I think it was about 2014 or so it first started in the early days. This isn't a process that sprung up overnight. So we recognise that a lot of work has gotten into getting Australia to where it is now in relation to this referendum, and that, even working within the system, the voice will be a good thing, because even if the Parliament of the day decides to ignore the voice, they still have to deal with the media backlash for doing so.
Yeah,
And if nothing else, that's a really important thing.
that's great that you said that. I've often thought that, just from my personal perspective, like I hear people who say, it's not going to have enough power, and then some people who think that's going to have too much power.
Yes.
But that is this, like, we as the electorate and the media as well, like, if they do something against the voice that is very unethical, then obviously they're going to have to explain and,
Yeah. And there are going to be some really tough conversations, if the referendum does succeed, and even if it doesn't, Anthony Albanese has said that he's left pathways open to still set up a voice. It can be just legislated into existence. He just wanted the referendum to make it much more difficult to be able to dismantle it if a change of government
because then it's in the
was to happen.
constitution.
Yes. So, there is still the likelihood of a voice to Parliament being set up regardless of the outcome for the referendum. What's really important to talk about with this conversation around the voice is the misinformation and the misconceptions that are out there. It's been said that it'll be a third chamber of parliament, and they'll have veto rights, and it'll affect the High Court, and
Yeah.
it's none of that is true. It's very easy to find the information that kind of debunks those claims. So it is just an advisory body, but it is a very important advisory body.
All right, well, let's look to the Queensland election. As you go through this next, when is it? It's the end of next year, October next year, I
Yes.
believe. You'll be finding candidates and doing all that kind of legwork.
Yeah.
What are the issues in Queensland that that the Australian Progressives are, seeking to tackle?
There's a lot of issues that that need to be addressed in Queensland,
I
and
mean, I know you mentioned integrity before, but
yeah,
yeah.
integrity is a really big one. I don't believe that the Queensland government is corrupt in the way that Joh Bjelke-Petersen, say, was in the 1980s. But there is definitely this air of entitlement and this lack of accountability that has crept into Queensland Labor and to the Queensland Parliament as well, that does need to be challenged. And I don't really see an alternative at this point in time, because the LNP isn't offering any sort of alternative, and the Greens only seem to be stuck, within that 10, 15 km radius of the Brisbane CBD. So getting outside of that, there's no one really to challenge them, Queensland Labor.
That's, yeah, interesting, because do you think that comes out of the fact that last time the LNP were in, they had quite a massive majority,
Yes.
and then Labor kind of swept in
Yeah.
and they've kind of built up a bit more? Do you think it comes from the fact that they've been, if the other side suffered that for one term election defeat,
Yes.
and then this side's like been in for a while, so they're feeling a bit overconfident, so you kind of get used to that
It does seem to
power?
happen. It
Yeah.
seems to happen in cycles. Since 1992, we've got this modern era of Queensland politics, that you could essentially write, 1989 and behind is a different era. But from 1992, with Wayne Goss and everything that happened since then, there's these cycles that you can see happen where Labor's in for around about three or so terms. They start to lose their accountability, to start to get a little bit entitled. They think they're going to be in there for much longer than they are. And then they do something that causes the Queensland public to say, nope, let's give the other guys a go.
Yeah, you're thinking like that towards the end of the Beattie into Bligh kind of zone that happened as well. Yeah.
Campbell Newman was very much a reaction to those Beattie Bligh years. And it looks like that's kind of happening again. There's an old adage in politics that oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them. And that was, in my opinion, really, really true in 2011. We had the Queensland Labor at the time. They had this privatisation push. They sold off parts of Queensland Rail. They sold off all these other institutions, and the people of Queensland really rejected that, and they didn't like that politics. They didn't like that entitlement, and so they said, "We'll give the other guys a go." And it just happened to be that Campbell Newman was that. Anathemic to the Queensland people. They said, no, one's enough. Let's go back. But we see that cycle happening again. And it happened in the 1990s as well, before Peter Beattie came in. There was a one-term Liberal Party government in, I think it was around about 96 or 97. So it's this cyclical thing of two or three terms of Labor government, one term of Liberal government, and then it goes back again. So
circuit
it's, yeah, basically, yeah. So don't get too cocky. We'll put the other guys in. But it looks like we're getting to that point again.
Yeah.
There's a lot of integrity issues with Mark Bailey. When I ran against him in 2020, he had the issues of those emails where he was using his private email for public business. The information that's come out about that is the fact that they were looking to try and make partisan appointments to the public service, which is, it's not corruption, but it is, in my opinion, really, really wrong. You need to have an independent public service, and the fact that we have this kind of capture that's creeping in is really, really bad. There's a few issues with accountability there that need to be reined in. Kind of giving the public service the ability to be more independent is really important. One of the main things that I'd like Queensland progressives to have as a policy suite in terms of integrity is having a review into the senior directorships of the Queensland Public Service. You say, we're not going to wipe the slate clean, but we're going to have a review process to say, was this appointment made on partisan grounds? Can you prove your independence? Can we set up kind of any sort of mechanism to make sure that you are acting independent of the government and you're not, acting party to the government. A big part of that is also expanding the scope of the Crime and Corruption Commission. Currently, the only way you can be referred to the Triple C is through the parliamentary inquiry or the parliamentary committee to corruption. And that's, we need to have a much more broad scale. We need it to be fully independent from parliament. They need to make their own assertions. We say we want to investigate this, so they will. It doesn't
rather
have
than
to
be
be.
called upon.
So expanding the scope and expanding the independence of the Crime and Corruption Commission is really, really important, because it will start to capture a lot more of that, what you'd call soft corruption. So a good example of that would be when we had Jackie Trad. One of the really negative stories that kind of led towards her demise at the last election was the fact that she bought a house in the catchment area that was in Cross River Rail, and she knew that it was going to go up in price. It's not technically corruption, though. No
But
one
it
was
looks
proved
bad.
anything. She was proved innocent. Whether it was, she knew what she was doing was wrong, or purposely benefiting from her position is hard to say. But it's what you would call a soft corruption. It erodes the integrity of Parliament, erodes people's perception of integrity in Parliament.
It's almost like they just need to, for some of those issues that you said, like go down to like a coffee shop and be like, "Hey, I'm thinking about buying a house that's going to be in the scene," and just see how
Good old pub test.
see what the public think. Yeah, pub test. That's what
Absolutely.
it is. Yeah. The other thing you mentioned there was, like you said, the Greens are kind of in this. They've got Maywar and South Brisbane. They're kind of in that sort of inner city zone, and when people think progressive, they think like Labor, Green, that kind of.
Yeah, for sure.
Traditionally, that's what they would think. How do you think you, the Australian Progressives, differ? How are you engaging with them? What issues do you see out of Brisbane that you also want to
Of
engage
course.
with?
I specifically want the Queensland progressives to focus in regional areas. Places like Toowoomba or Cairns or Gladstone, there are some really big issues in those areas that aren't being addressed by any of the other parties. Toowoomba in particular, it's seen as this really conservative stronghold. It's purely LNP territory, and no one really wants to touch it. But there's really strong issues with homelessness. There's really strong issues with mining in particular. So all of the coal mines and the gas wells that are in the area, it's a really strong issue that the farmers are trying to fight against because they don't want gas wells on their land. But the Queensland government is just letting all of this kind of fossil fuel exploration to go ahead, and no one's challenging them on it because they know that it's an LNP area. They're not going to care about it. No one's going to challenge them. That's not right. So that's what somewhere we want to focus on.
It's one of those things where, like, if you can even bring a safe seat down to marginal, like, then people start to take notice. Hey,
Absolutely.
yeah.
Yeah. And we saw that federally in Toowoomba as well. There was an independent candidate, Susie Holt. She ended up being the on preferences, she ended up being the second party preferred.
Yeah. We also, I mean, I should probably come back to, I missed one of your the things your party's looking to tackle, which is another thing's climate change, which I guess links in with what you were just talking about, you know, fossil fuels then. In terms of the state Queensland government, what would you what differences would you like to implement as the Australian progresses in that space?
The biggest one is just stopping all new coal and gas exploration. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that came out in earlier this year was completely steadfast, unequivocal. There cannot be any new coal mines. There cannot be any new gas wells if we are to keep climate change to with any sort of livable standard. And the federal and state governments really haven't listened that much to it. There's a lot of new mines going in. There's a lot of new gas wells going in.
Does that come back to the same thing we're talking about with homelessness, where you kind of like look the other way for long enough and hopefully it just stops being an issue?
Pretty much, yeah. It really feels like that. They just don't seem to, their ears are being too much filled by the sound of donations. They can't really hear much else. Fossil fuel companies and the fossil fuel lobby itself are one of the bigger donors to the both the major parties. Something that I'd really love to see Queensland Progressives tackle in terms of integrity would be in terms of donations reform. Adding fossil fuel companies and lobby groups to the banned donors list, along with gambling and cigarettes. That would go a long way to kind of breaking that nexus between fossil fuel companies and government, and in particular gambling and government in Queensland. That's a really, really big issue that I spent 10 years working in hospitality. I worked in gaming rooms and pubs and clubs. I've seen the worst side of that industry, and gambling in particular is a really personally strong policy area that I have, and reforming that and breaking that nexus of donations to parliament or to government political parties is a really, really important thing there.
And it also just stops those like awkward conversations, you know, like why is your party against this? Like, you can't just say, oh, it's because they're donating money to us.
Absolutely,
You know, you have to come up with something. So it just cuts out all that kind of those
Absolutely,
awkward
yeah.
conversations.
And getting rid of the workarounds that lobbies tend to find. Property developers can't donate directly to political parties, but the real estate industry of Queensland does make donations. There's lobby groups that do, and we don't know where they get their money from. Or they have, Queensland Labor was just in the news because they've just restarted the cash for consult, as the Greens have called it, donation program. So you sit down $10,000 a head business lunches, and you have personal access to a government minister. That's like it's just a corruption of
What's wrong,
politics, in
Edward?
my
What's
opinion.
wrong, Ben?
So, you know, yeah. There's all of those little hidden ways that these lobby groups find their way into government ears.
Now, last time you ran for Miller, what did you learn from that experience that, you know, that you're going to take into this experience for next year's election?
I learned a lot with that. It was a really, really tough campaign to run as an independent, particularly as a first-time candidate as well. We were right in the middle of COVID, so you couldn't have any town halls. We couldn't do any of that stuff. State politics doesn't really have online community halls the way the federal does, so it's really hard to engage people at state government level.
I was just going to say, I remember, I don't think you could even really probably hand people how to vote. It was all like, stuff's on the table over there.
It was all hands off. Like the council elections were even worse, but that was a really fun one. So I'm actually really looking forward to the council elections next year, and I'm hoping we'll have candidates as well. So the plan for Queensland Progressives is to be registered before the end of this year, and so that'll give us a few months to kind of ramp up and get ready for council, because there's a lot of issues with council as well.
Are you thinking, obviously this is just, you know, you're still setting things up, but are you thinking Brisbane, or are you thinking across multiple councils,
as many as we can get involved with? Brisbane is obviously the biggest one, but there are issues all across the entire local government sector. And you know, particularly with things like planning laws for housing, we're seeing in the media at the moment with those tent cities, the political reactions to them, there's a lot being left on the table in terms of what like local council can do. And something that's really frustrating me in terms of Brisbane City Council is that you've got this kind of cheap politics being played with things like the Pinkenba quarantine facility. And on the one hand, you've got the Lord Mayor saying that we should use it, and you know, instead of going to the federal government, who has ownership of that site, is going to try and attack the state government and saying they're not letting us, you know, use this. It's kind of cheapening the entire debate. But at the same time, there are dozens of completely unused Brisbane City Council buildings that could be utilised as emergency accommodation for people experiencing homelessness. And there are great, fantastic groups like Bed Down, who's a charity that specialises in those kind of looking at those alternative spaces to support people and get them off the streets, that could help in those kind of activation of those spaces. But we're not seeing that at all. We're just saying, oh yeah, it's Pinkenba, you know, it's a, you know, if we can score some points with that, then that's great. If we don't, then, you know, we at least look like we've tried, but they're not doing anything else either.
That makes me think it is kind of interesting the way that they kind of attack each other, and then it's like, well, but then when something like the Olympics comes, they're like, let's all join together. And
yes, absolutely. It's absolutely infuriating.
I just find it interesting, the issues that unite parties.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, seeing the way that they, in the public, they go and attack each other, and it's all politics, and it's, you know, going at each other's throats, and then you go to official functions and they're happy as anything. It's a very interesting dichotomy.
Now, just lastly, because I know we've been talking for a little while, so I don't want to keep you for forever. Last time we spoke, I always end with a question about legacy, and last time you said, you want to leave behind a more inclusive society, a society that cares more for each other. You want to see a move towards clean energy, a clean energy future, and away from fossil fuels. And you'd love to see a more culturally inclusive society in Parliament. On that criteria, like, I know for you personally, like, you're obviously ramping up for an election, and hopefully you'll be in a position where you can, you know, be in a parliament to make these changes. How do you think we've gone in the last 4 years in relation to those things? Like, how do you think the legacy is looking at the moment? I mean, I know it'll be different because it'll be you personally, obviously. There's things you're doing, and then there's society and government as a whole. So maybe How do you think you're going with that?
Yeah.
And then how do you think society and government's going with that?
Yeah. And there's always a lot more work to be done, no matter what you're looking at.
Yeah.
I think that we're still in the really early stages of setting up the Party for Queensland Progressives. But that's actually a really exciting thing for us, because we have the ability to set things up to be really inclusive from the start. You know, we don't have to try and retrofit the party with rules and targets and membership targets and that kind of thing. You know, we can go from the outset to community groups and get people from different cultural groups involved and say, hey, we want to set this up, we want you in from the beginning. And that's something that I've been really focused on. I want to run as a candidate. I see myself being in parliament as, you know, where I would like to end up. In the current constitution we've written for Queensland Progressives, if you sit on the national executive during elections, you have to either resign from your position or step back from duties in order to run, so you don't have people kind of crossing over the bounds of party organisation. So, you know, I'm the state president now, I'm getting everything set up, but I recognise my privilege as not only a white person, but I'm cisgender, I'm straight, I'm ticking every box on the staff pale mail. Yeah, I'd love to see someone from a different background, or someone from, a woman leading the party, someone that's and actually going to represent the multicultural Australia that we see on the streets but we don't see in Parliament.
Yeah. Well, I think that might be a good place to stop. I will put in the episode description where people can go to your website and find out more info and some contact details and stuff in there. But thanks for coming on. Best of luck with the election next year, and good luck with everything.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.